because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God
bless. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Dye's summary of the news this week. It's the Republican Party's version of Survivor, J.R. Okay. And it stopped in Milwaukee.
Yes.
This incredible, whatever you want, 12 presidential candidates in Milwaukee for two debates.
Yes.
Why Milwaukee? Why Wisconsin?
Do you think Rice Priebus, being Wisconsin native, had something to do with it?
RNC yeah.
RNC chair? Do you think? Now, there are certain people who want to think that maybe Rines thought, well, you know, if Scott Walker's still in the race, it might be a nice little boost for him.
Oh, a little Homer effect there?
Maybe. You know, that's a theory. But there's also just that, you know, you got to have him somewhere. And we didn't have any debates in 2008 or 2012. So why don't you come to Milwaukee or Wisconsin for one?
Yeah,
so we're actually getting two of them. One Republican, one Democratic debate.
That's true. But let's go back. Let's just talk Republicans. Wisconsin cast 2.3% of the total votes for president in 2012. Mm-hmm. How many Electoral College votes do we have?
10.
You knew that. Congratulations. Yes. Last time a Republican won a presidential...
1984.
Okay. So that doesn't write us large in the Republican landscape.
If you look at the tier of battleground states anymore, right? When I first started... Wisconsin was the battleground state. 2000, my first presidential election in Wisconsin, 5,500 votes roughly. The second one, 11,000 some votes. Then it became Barack Obama's turn where it was, you know, blowouts. The map has shifted somewhat that you're talking about Nevada and Virginia, sometimes North Carolina, Florida being the battlegrounds. We've moved away from the model of 15 years ago, which was the Rust Belt. It was all about Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio. Those are the ones, Ohio, those are the big states. So, but it's a reflection of the map shifting. Demographically, we've shifted a little bit. So that's kind of happening. But we're still a state to watch. It can be competitive. Just because Barack Obama ran away with it twice in a row doesn't mean that it's an assured thing is going to happen. I would say that if Hillary Clinton's the nominee, she would have, if at the very least, home field advantage, if you will, in Wisconsin. It would tilt her direction. But it's not a guarantee she'll win.
Which is why, one of the reasons Bill Clinton's coming here for a fundraiser for her.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
she wants to do well here, too. I mean, you know, if you think about the map of presidential primaries going forward, the Clintonites think that Bernie Sanders can't get past March 1st because it's the SEC primary, they call it, all the southeastern states, large African-American populations. He does not do well with those voters in the polls for whatever reason. They think that's one of her firewalls. Yes, he may win New Hampshire. They may be close in Iowa, but come March 1st, she wipes him out, and he's, like, struggling after that. And we're a full month after that. So,
yeah.
But still... You know, it could, in theory, you could see Bernie Sanders coming to Wisconsin and getting like a little jolt of like energy if he does well here. So then, yeah, all kinds of
himself.
Things. Yeah.
Well, having 12 Republican presidential candidates allowed us to mingle with the big mm-hmm. feet and the pundits. I mean, Wisconsin Politics had an event headlined by Chuck Todd.
Yeah, 15th anniversary, been around for that long. And
congratulations.
Chuck Todd,
what did Mr. Todd say?
Well, a couple things. He listed who he thought had a chance. A very interesting point. People are so unhappy with the establishment. He said it would be a great year for a sane Ross Perot. Now, one, it implies Ross Perot wasn't sane
the
back
giant
in.
Giant sucking sound is the chops. Go ahead.
But if you think about it, it's an interesting theory that, you know, if you really had somebody who was a figure who had money, had an opportunity, had a well-known name, could possibly make a dent because people don't like the establishment. That's why Carson and Trump are doing well. That's why Sanders is doing well. He's not Clinton, you know. So that's an interesting theory. Another one was that if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, he theorized that Paul Ryan would walk away from the House speakership because his theory was Ryan saved the party possibly from losing the House. I mean, the maps are so good for Republicans. They should not lose that House for a long, long time. But it would be such disarray, his theory went, that if Ryan hadn't run, they would have been vulnerable losing the House in 2016. Now that he's there, he's got a calming figure, they should keep it. But if Clinton wins and Ryan's still Speaker, he'll become John Boehner Part 2 because the Tea Party wing of the party will not want to negotiate with a Hillary Clinton, a President Clinton, right?
That's fascinating.
So what is Paul Ryan? He becomes then Boehner trying to keep these guys happy.
Yeah.
Because Paul Ryan wants to get stuff done. He is a doer, not a let's sit back and
he's
wait.
Captain Wonk. Go ahead.
So what does he do? That's an interesting theory. I think the people he named that would be a real shot for the presidency right now were down to like four or five people. One of his theories, which was also interesting, was that there could be a brokered convention for Republicans come the summer, because if you look at the map, it was designed to speed the process up. That's why they moved the convention up to July in Cleveland, right? They want to get a nominee in place, start spending that general election money right away, and have an advantage over Democrats. Well, because you have such a wide open field right now, unless it coalesces at some point around somebody, you could go to Cleveland without a clear winner. Now, if it's somebody who has all but that much left, the delegates to come, that would be an obvious shift toward him or her.
Sure.
But if you have a lot of like 35% of delegates, 32%, 20, if you have like three, four people who are right there, what do you do then? He threw out the idea of Mitt Romney becoming the nominee again, that they would say, well, this isn't working, and probably turn. It was a theory.
Did you have him at a happy hour before he made things like that with politics?
So it was an interesting talk.
Well, yeah, it sounds very, very interesting. Yeah. Well, okay, let's talk about Walker's role during when all the presidential. He appeared with Jeb Bush. He appeared with Marco Rubio. He also went out of his way to say, I am not endorsing. Why isn't he endorsing?
Well, if you think about it, why would you endorse right now? It's November. Our primary is not until April. What impact might you have if you endorse right now? Probably not a whole lot. It's also the theory that any politician endorsing a candidate right now is not going to have a big impact because they don't really like politicians right now. They like the anti-establishment.
That's a good point.
So why do it now? So if you are Walker, and if you do want to endorse, you probably want to do it closer to our primary in April. You'd have more impact. Look at the map for us, by the way. I believe there's something like March 26th, 29th, where that Saturday is for us. There's nothing from that last Saturday in March until April 5th. It's wide open for like 7 days, nine days for us. Then, nothing for 2 weeks. We will be the epicenter of, if there's a primary still going on both sides, the epicenter for a couple weeks there. And our impact, how we vote in April, could shape the race going forward. So you would think, save your powder until then. Also, don't bet the wrong horse.
That's true. So our April primary this time around could really matter.
Especially, you know, we moved up to February in 08 and had a big impact in that it didn't seal the deal for Barack Obama, but it fed the idea of inevitability. Yes, that thing dragged out for much longer after that. But after Wisconsin, when he won by, was it 17 or whatever? I can't remember how many points it was. A huge win here. It was like, well, this guy's got the momentum. Yes, Clinton won a couple other places or at least one more place after that, but he had the momentum after that.
Okay.
2012.
Quiz time. Mitt Romney won our presidential primary in 2012. The date was April 3rd. What percentage did he get? You knew how many votes we had in the Electoral College. You must have, like...
I blocked that part out.
Okay. He had 44%. Who finished second in our April 2012 primary?
Don't remember, but it was kind of the end for Santorum. Remember that?
Santorum, 37%. Who finished third? And then I'll be done bugging you. Ron Paul.
Yeah.
Not Rand. Ron. Yes. Ron Paul. 11%.
But look at that. I mean, Santorum was kind of knocked out after our primary last time. There's also a theory that if it's becoming, there's somebody who people are coalescing around, Wisconsin could be a knockout blow for somebody or a momentum builder for somebody of the air of inevitability. But with the polls the way they are right now, that's a big question mark, what's going to look like come April.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, new subject. I wasn't in the state senate at 2:30 last Saturday morning. Were you?
I was. Oh, yes.
You were?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Because you saw senators give final approval to the campaign finance bill.
Yes.
And earlier about midnight, the...
GAB bill.
Government Accountability No More bill. Now let's talk about some of the changes that the senators made. First of all, there was a Journal Sentinel headline that they're going to go back to the idea that you must disclose your employer if you give, I think, more than $200 in the new bill.
The threshold is $100. They want it. Some members want to go to $200. That was the compromise, if you will.
So how did the bill come out?
It goes back. In the end, the assembly version that was passed had no disclosure anymore. They wiped it out essentially. And a few senators were talking about, the Republican senators were talking about bringing back kind of a compromise, $200. But in the end, they told us members were not going to go for it. They were adamantly against doing that. And so they didn't work. They didn't have the support to do it. And away it went.
So what's the final compromise? If somebody gives a candidate more than what, 100 or 200?
There's no disclosure.
There is no disclosure
at
all?
It's wiped out.
No occupations, no employers.
So, and the Republican argument is that, look, we had these Act 10 protests, and it became, the businesses were targeted because of they gave money to ex-candidate, there's a chilling effect in the First Amendment, that's not right. So that was kind of the Republican idea of why is this information important, and if my employees, let's say I'm J.R. Ross, Inc., if my employees are all giving to somebody else and I'm not, why should I be punished for what they're doing, or held accountable for what they're doing, or blamed for what they're doing?
Well, this makes it harder for investigative reporters and investigative and curious members of the public to trace who's really giving the money, doesn't it?
Sure. Right. We've both looked through campaign finance report for years. It's a treasure trove of like who's giving, what industries they're from. I mean, there are certain names that you kind of assume might be that person, but until you see the donor information, you don't know for sure it's, you know, the person you're looking at. So that, it helps, if you will, detail who's supporting these people.
You bet we've gone through those reports in the past, but we won't be able to under the new in terms of linking
You can still find
employers.
The names, but are you sure that name is that person, you know, unless you have the address in the back of your head somewhere
And if
else.
Somebody gives in February and it's not disclosed until June, do they still even work there?
Yeah.
But the Senate said, we want a limit on corporate, union, and tribal donations. We'll put a $12,000 limit to legislative committees. Where did that one come from? Because the assembly was wide open.
I think there's like kind of a nervousness of the wide open, like, you know, Wild West type accusation of, well, just let it flow. So that's probably a little bit part of it. Part of what you're seeing in the campaign finance bill was a softening, if you will, by some senators were like, I don't really feel good about going all the way on some of these things. And that's part of what happened.
And then senators did get their way. Of course, the bill would abolish the Government Accountability Board, set up elections and an ethics. And senators said you have to have two retired judges on the ethics, not the elections part.
Yes. So the way it works, remember, you have six-member commissions, both of them. In both cases, the four legislative leaders appoint one person each. Then there is, for the Elections Commission, a pool that each side nominates their municipal or county clerks. The governor picks one from each, so it's always a balance still. Three Democratic appointees, three Republican appointees. With the Ethics Commission, that pool will be retired judges. It'll still be a Democratic pool and a Republican pool. Now, the question becomes, you can appoint up to three people. If you're the Democrats, well, if you only appoint one person? You know, you could do that. The big rub becomes, and this came an issue on the floor, of what if they don't approve that nominee? What if, let's just say, for the heck of it, Kevin Kennedy is the Democratic nominee for the Elections or Ethics Commission.
Okay.
All right?
That's a good example.
Or the Senate, Republican senators are not big fans of Kevin Kennedy, right?
Right.
Will they vote to confirm him? What if they put somebody up there, either side put somebody up there that the other side doesn't like? And John Ruckbach talked about this. If you don't confirm that person, and I don't really worry about you guys, but maybe the next couple legislatures, if you don't confirm that person and you leave a vacancy, it's not 3-3 anymore, it's 3-2, and you have an advantage. There's an incentive for you guys to possibly play games with this, and we don't like that. Now, would they? It would probably undermine the entire thing. And Luther Olson, who had pushed for some changes to the bill, including the judges, said, we own this. We want to make it work. If it doesn't work, it blows up on us. We have an incentive, if you will, do this right.
But one thing that still strikes me is you have the ledge leaders are single-handedly going to be picking the members of both commissions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they even tell the governor who he's got to appoint, don't they?
Yep. Give him those pools.
Yep.
Got picks from them.
Yep.
And of course, if you, it's up to three, so you could limit the pool if you wanted to and try and force his hand.
Yeah. And I think Speaker Voss is on record as saying that none of these Senate changes are deal breakers, which means this Monday the Assembly is going to approve the Senate amendments and put them on the governor's desk.
When I talked to him over the weekend, he said that nothing he saw was a deal breaker. He wants to talk to his caucus first. I believe they're going to caucus Monday, probably on the floor. But there was nothing that anybody's raised an issue with since, you know, Friday night, early Saturday morning that we could go, okay, there's a big issue. Unless it's percolating underneath the surface, we're not hearing big problems.
There aren't any big problems. Okay, new subject. I was in the Senate committee room when Milwaukee Mayor Barrett and Police Chief Flynn arguing passionately for this assembly passed bills that said if you're a felon in possession of a gun, you go away to prison for a minimum. And then if you're a felon and you committed a serious crime, you go away for five more years. Here's what intrigues me. Those bills were passionately argued by Tanya Johnson, opposed by Lena Taylor. Why did they split the black community?
Good question. So Lena's supported other gun rights bills, but I mean, they're just a different ideal or approach, if you will, to this. If I remember right, Lena's pointed out that she's not a big fan of minimum sentences in general because they are punitive. She believes they disproportionately affect the black community, especially in Milwaukee. So there's some issues like that, I think, at play there.
Yeah, but look at the backdrop here. I just checked with the Journal Sentinel yesterday. As of yesterday, there had been 131 murders in Milwaukee. As of this week, last year, total 86. So it's a tough.
And that's an issue Mayor Barrett's going to be looking at come spring, when he's up for election.
Yeah, it's a tough no. Okay, new subject. I was surprised. My surprise of the week was Voss goes before the Journal Sentinel edit board, and he said, we're willing to reinvent, reconsider, abolish, blow up, I'm sorry, rework, retool, you come up with another word, the WEDIC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Were you surprised that only 4.5 years out, they're willing to throw it under the bus?
Well, they realize it's become an issue for them. And the question becomes, what do you do with it? Now, the governor had proposed in the budget, right, to combine WEDIC and WEDA, which he said they were redundant. Well, it also would have given an opportunity to combine Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Association and rework it, possibly reform what you're doing.
Right.
But lawmakers were not thrilled about the idea of merging these two agencies because they didn't feel like they had enough information. It was kind of odd the way it was pushed. I mean, you on down the line. Instead, in the budget, remember they did? They went off a loan program and said, you can give these loans until this date. After that, we're done.
They also took the governor off the board.
Took the board.
Because he wanted to be a part of a board because he thought he'd have 250,000 new private sector jobs, fell less than half, more than half short of that. Go ahead.
So he wanted off the board. Now, the question becomes, what can you, now, what Robin talked about was reaching some kind of agreement with Democrats what to do. Well, is that possible? That's a good question because Rick Gudick, for example, senator from Fond du Lac, talked to him after he did a tour of the state for the Economic Development Committee. He thinks WEDIC has a great reputation at the local level with what it does locally. The problem is these bad loans. These things have kind of gotten controversy. How do you clean that up? He wants to bring the loan program back. He thinks it's a good thing. The question is how do you, you know, rework it? And oh, by the way, he wants lawmakers off the board. He wants the partisan hacks, in his words, gone because they're, in his mind, looking to undermine what's going on. The Democrats will tell you we need to be there to have an eye on things because these guys are screwing up left and right. We had another group of execs leave this past few weeks.
Yes.
There's a problem going on
here.
The
whole senior leadership team is turned over, and you have a brand new CEO in Mark Hogan. And now he looks over and says, where's my senior leadership team? I'm sorry, they all resigned. Now, the good news is you get to pick your own senior leadership team. The bad news is there's a learning curve for anybody you pick.
This all goes back to how it was created in some ways in that they went from the Commerce Department to WEDIC in like almost no time.
You want to talk shotgun wedding? That was a shotgun wedding.
Especially in state government, which moves so slowly. It was lightning fast. Happened in the middle of like, there's Act 10 that spring. All of a sudden, WEDIC comes up. It wasn't really the focus, if you will. They took the eye off the ball. The person they put in charge, if you ask the people who are involved, they will all point fingers at what was going on and what wasn't being done. And it never had a solid foundation. They've been trying to recover from that ever since. So the question is, okay, if you want to rework it, how do you rework it? Do you want to do these risky loans? Now, people like Gudex will say, these startup corporations or companies can't get these loans from a traditional bank. We should do them because it is a risk, but the reward is great. If they can't find financing somewhere else, we have a good idea. Let's invest in them. They're Wisconsin jobs.
That sounds like Gudex is saying WEDIC should become a version of the Export-Import Bank for Wisconsin, my friend.
Well, it's the question, like what role does it play and how do you do those loans if you do them again? Because there are people who are not big fans of it. Tommy Thompson wrote a op-ed piece saying we should not in government be in the business of giving out loans. That's the private sector's
job. That's
the
old we shouldn't be picking out winners and losers theory, right? Go ahead.
So what do you do with it? And I don't think they have a good idea just yet.
Okay, well, I want to go back. Speaker Voss told the Journal Sentinel, I almost think WEDIC is so tarnished that we need to figure out a new model to fix it. JFC co-chair Nygren said it's become a political football and it shouldn't be. Assembly Democratic leader Barca, I hope it leads to real reform. Here's my question. Is this a head fake by Voss and Nygren? Or are they serious about reinventing WEDIC?
If you're talking about a bipartisan bill that truly works it, I don't know how you get there right now.
Okay.
Now, can you? Absolutely. Could they possibly do a bill? Sure. But look at the calendar right now. They're going to come back, and the going theory in the Capitol is they're going to come back and be done by the end of February and go home.
They do.
So
I agree with that.
Done before an election.
Civil service reform. Go ahead and some of the issues that we talked about.
They still haven't figured out fetal tissue, for example. They still haven't figured out the Planned Parenthood bills, at least.
Civil service reform. Are we going to put limits on how often school districts can schedule referendums?
So there are all these issues that are still out there. They don't want to do big controversial things. They want to do positive things. John Nygren's heroin bills, the second kind of wave, if you will, of his opiate addiction.
Hope bills.
Yep. To get at that, those things they want to do. But getting a WEDIC bill done between now and the end of February, it would be a tough lift, especially when a bipartisan one.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. I'm so intrigued. So the state budget tells Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley, you must name an overseer for 3 failing MPS schools in the next school year and up to 5 failing MPS schools in the following year. So he names Demon Means, the Mequon-Themesville superintendent, as, let me get the term right, Commissioner of Opportunity Schools. Mm-hmm. Now, in an interview with him about 3 weeks ago, he said, I didn't ask for this, but I was saddled with this by two Republicans, Senator Darling and Representative Dale Coinga. Mm-hmm. So he goes out and he names a rising star in Wisconsin K-12 and an African-American. But, Jay, here's my question. Did he do Demon Means any favors? Given the context, because now we have one more education czar. Czar is a wrong term, but you have Tony Evers and you have Ms. Driver as MPS superintendent. And, excuse me, Chris Abele is in a reelect with Senator Chris Larson. Mm-hmm. Did he do Mr. Means any favors?
Well, it's interesting that you have like these almost competing school systems going to be set up in Milwaukee. You have the choice program and charter schools, which obviously, look, you were here when it was created, I wasn't, but it was created and talked about when I first got here as if you create competition, MPS will improve. That hasn't happened, and you don't hear the competition argument anymore. You hear the opportunity argument now about choice schools, voucher yes. schools, that if you create, if these kids are in failing schools, give them the option to go somewhere else
right.
and give them a chance. So there's that system. You have MPS, which can just be a problem. It is a failing school district, let's be honest. It is not doing well. There are bright spots in MPS. Let's not diminish those. But there are problems. How do you fix them? There have been ideas over the years. Remember Jim Doyle? Let's take it over. That was one of his ideas. Tommy Thompson talked about breaking it up.
He did.
Many years ago.
And it never. And his idea never even got a public hearing. Go ahead. You're right.
So now you have this, created by two Republicans. Dale Coinga, when you talk to him, he is passionate about trying to find solutions for Milwaukee. Now, people in Milwaukee, some lawmakers and officials go, this guy's not from Milwaukee. Why is he coming in and imposing on us his solution? Why isn't it generated by us? You need to push back about, well, the school board isn't very active. It doesn't do what it should be doing. I mean, this constant barrage of finger pointing and who's to blame. They won't sell empty schools. They won't do that.
Right.
So you have another option, if you will, to try and fix these. Will it work? I don't know.
Well, and let's look at Demon Means is a rising star mm-hmm. in K-12 circles. He's an African American, but he now leads, superintendent of one of the richest school districts, and now he's going to be asked to oversee three and maybe up to five of schools in the poorest district. Do you see any contradiction there that's going to hurt him?
And how many schools did we take over? I mean, it's up to three the first year, up to five. So you can see a gradual erosion of MPS that you can be picking schools off constantly.
Right.
Where is the line going to be? Will this work? How long do you figure out if it has worked? There are issues ahead of him to try and figure out. And there's also the complaint of you're putting the county executive in charge of an education. Why? He's not the mayor. He's a county executive. He represents this wide swath of suburban areas, not just the city of Milwaukee. Why him? Well, because Abele works with Republicans. You know, Mayor Barrett is not the best friends with Scott Walker, obviously. So there's that issue as well. There's a little bit of mistrust right now a little bit of suspicion about what's going on.
Yeah. Mr. Means, let's just look at his career. I mean, it's a stellar career. 84, he starts as a Hempstead High teacher, coach, advisor, assistant principal, director of human resources, assistant superintendent. 2007, named superintendent of the Mequon-Themesville. Doyle, 2010, mm-hmm. names him as a Wisconsin representative to the Education Commission of the States. 2014, co-chair with Superintendent Evers of the Task Force on Closing the Achievement Gap. He's an intriguing guy, but I'm going to come back to my question. Are there too many partisan and political walls in his path? So it's just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah,
it really is an amazing appointment. We'll be watching that. Okay. Time for you to score. Wiz Politics, stock market.
All right, so rises to Scott Walker. I mean, let's be honest.
Why?
He has work to do in the state, right? We'll see new Marquette numbers next week. I'm sure we'll talk about those next Friday. He has work to do at home, but that guy got wooed by Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio.
He got a shout out from Fiorina
mm-hmm.
on the main stage.
It goes to show you a couple of things. That one, even though his poll numbers were bad in the horse race, if you will, at the presidential primary, he still had good favorable unfavorables. He still has a good network of donors. A good batch of supporters. If you could win over Scott Walker as endorsement, he could be a surrogate for you before the primary in April. He could go to Iowa and talk for you. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why you might want a Scott Walker on your team. Now, will he get in there? We don't know. But it shows you that there's still some, he's got work to do here, but he's got some pull, if you will, nationally. Let's be honest, he got a little bit of love this week from the national field.
Well, but Reince Priebus put it in Milwaukee, mm-hmm. thinking that Walker would still be on that stage.
Yeah, that didn't work out.
There wouldn't be eight on the main stage. There'd be nine. It didn't work out. Okay. So he's rising. Mixed.
Shirley Abramson. So she announces this week she's dropping her appeal.
She does that the day before Chief Justice Rogan's act gives her her first state of the judiciary speech. Go ahead.
So let's remember. So voters approved in April the constitutional amendment that allows the justices to pick the Chief Justice. For 150 years, whatever it went to the most tenured member of the court, which was Justice Abramson, for 19 years. She's dumped almost immediately once the service has the opportunity to do this. She files a lawsuit. It's knocked down by the federal courts. She says she's going to appeal. Let's be honest. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. When I talked to lawyers, they said she had a tough battle to win in the federal courts, especially when you lose the district court level with a Democratic appointee of the federal bench. That's not a great sign. Mm-hmm. So maybe this was a face-saving move to drop it. But it also takes us off the docket, if you will. She said in her statement she thought she was right, but it would be a hollow victory. It would take until the end of her term. This clears the deck.
The end of her term, 2019.
She promises to be a not be a timid voice, if you will, the rest of time she's on the court. Now, let's be honest. Her career is so long and distinguished, this would be a footnote, all right, or a small mention in her like final summary, if you will, of all she did when she retires. But why make it longer than you have to? Why have it be like five lines rather than two lines? You know, get it out of the way, it's done. The other good thing for her was that Rogan-Sack went out of her way in that address.
That's where I was going.
To say.
To hold out an olive branch.
To
Let's
thank
pause
her.
For a minute to note and salute all the achievements that former Chief Justice Abramson. Go ahead, finish it.
Let's be honest. They have not been the best of friends on the court lately, right?
Right.
A lot of tension
Hardly
there.
Hardly talk.
So now, is it a hollow olive branch? Was it a public thing? Is it sincere? Will it make any changes? We have no, I mean, the things that happen behind closed doors, those guys, it must be fascinating to watch. We only see the public show, if you will.
And there's a new player, Justice Bradley. And so you have a new chemistry assembling on the court.
So, but this at least, for Abramson, this puts this thing behind her. You know, she moved forward, served out her career without this hanging over the court. And, you know, when she retires, it's still going to be one of the most distinguished members that court's ever seen. Longest serving chief justice probably ever that we'll see in Wisconsin.
And thanks for giving me an idea. It's time for Wisconsin I to again ask her, Justice Abramson, to sit down for a newsmaker's interview. She said, wait until all this drama plays out. So I'll ask her again. Falling.
Well, disclosure. I mean, we talked about that, the campaign finance bill. Now, for Republicans who talked about this, they feel like people are using that or misusing that information to chill First Amendment rights, to go after people, that's not fair. The other side are saying, well, look, you know, we use this information to see who's trying to influence elections, who's trying to, like, push candidates one way or another. It helps illustrate the campaigns and what's going on. Mm-hmm. And now, on the floor, Devin Lemon, you correctly pointed out that there was a case with a railroad executive a few years back where he was directing money to employees to give to others.
Yes.
That began with a tip, which is what Lemon, you pointed out. But it was made easier to nail down where these contributions were because the information available in the court campaign finance records, you know. So
who they work for.
I'm sure the prosecutors have other tools, but it was an easier tool to get this done. I always try when we talk, I'm giving you what I hear, not what I think. This is a hard issue to be totally impartial about because this affects what I do for a living. But for journalists, you're like going, hey, you're taking a tool in the toolbox for how I can explain to my readers what's going on. So it's just, it's one piece that goes, and, you know, Republicans, Rob Coles voted against the campaign finance bill because he's like, I'm always been for transparency.
I believe in transparency.
And so this is an issue. So that's going to go away. And it's kind of, for us, it's one less juicy nugget to find.
It is. It's one less thing that we look for. Okay, before we adjourn, you mentioned Senator Gudex. Can you get an answer out of him on whether he's going to seek reelection, my friend?
He is. Till last time I talked to him about it, he said he's got a lot of options ahead of him and he's still trying to figure it out.
Which is almost indicating he may not seek re-election.
It's been a hot topic in conversation in the Capitol.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for Friday, the 13th of November.